Good afternoon. Welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
I'm not even going to give Bill a bad time this hour.
No, you shouldn't.
I got it all out of my system last hour.
Thank you very much.
Mike, it's your turn. Oh, sorry. No, I didn't mean that. So it's Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms. We're here working diligently to bring you information on Mother's Day. I'd like to say because we have no lives, but we seem to be busy. So I guess we do have lives. All right. Mr. Ariza is our hostage for the second hour again. We're talking about the gas thing. You can get to the information about this. I made us a shortcut. You can go through gascrisis.org, and that'll take you directly to the page that curates all of the stuff on this issue. So we have 9 different shows, so you can listen to those. They're free to listen to, free to send to people. You can post them on Facebook, all sorts of stuff. We make it easy and free. On there are the letters from 3 of the refineries that have come out this year. So 2 from PBF, 2 from Marathon, 2 from Chevron. They own 2 refineries each. So 1 letter from each company and what they intend to do, which is close if the California Air Resources Board doesn't figure it out. And just for easy math, that would be 6 of the 7 refineries in the state of California. Oops. Worth reading the letters. There is also a 2-page paper on there written by Professor Michael Miché, who we have had on the show multiple times, and also Professor James Rector out of Berkeley. It's called California Gasoline Supply Outlook, A Disaster in the Making, dated April 15th, 2026. Worth a read. It's 2 pages, page and 3/4, easy read, and it should give you a real heads up in case you were thinking that this wasn't actually a problem. I dare you to read that and think it's not a problem. There's also like an 8-page, it's labeled as comprehensive analysis, and that has been used multiple times and is cited by all of the companies who wrote to the California Air Resources Board requesting they change their policy so they could continue to operate and provide, gas, diesel, jet fuel, propane, all the good stuff that
we use every day
makes us not cavemen. So
for all those folks out there that think these high gas prices are all going to go away as soon as this Iran war is over, what do you say to them, Mike?
Shazam!
I hear it all the time. Oh, this is all Trump's
it's
fault.
It's all Trump's fault.
This war is driving gas prices up, and it has a small effect on that, but prices aren't going to go down when this war is over, are they?
Had we utilized the resources in our own state, we would have been affected 0%. Huh.
Been isolated.
Wouldn't that have been a good idea?
Well, and now there's two things to look at, too, to that effect. First of all, the prices started going up and Valero went down, and then continued to go up. We've gone up quite a bit more in the rest of the country. So you look at that right there. And then the other thing is, there's no place in the country that's talking about shortages.
Right.
Even our drive-by media here in California is starting to talk about shortages. There's no place in the country talking about shortages.
Right.
So when this war does end, when the strait opens back up, the rest of the country is going to go back because of Venezuela and other things. I agree with a lot of these analysts that say we're probably going to have a crude oil glut. So crude oil prices are going to drop, and gasoline prices could very well be lower than they've ever been in years and years and years in the rest of the country. But no, California, because at minimum, you got to fill up the crude oil tankers, start going through Hormuz. They got to go to Asia. They got to get those tanks, crude oil tanks, back up to a sufficient level. Then they raise their rates. Then they have to bring, the refineries will raise their rates. Then they have to get their product tanks, gasoline, jet, and diesel, up to reasonable levels. And that's got to be stable. Then they'll start the fuel tankers coming to us again. Right there, you're looking at a month. Travel time across the Pacific, you're looking at a minimum of 35 days to 45 days. So if we're lucky, 2.5 months, maybe even 3 months, probably pushing it well into the summer.
And then I hear people say, oh, we'll get all this oil from Venezuela, and that'll solve the problem. Talk to us about the difference between that oil and the oil we get overseas and why we can't use it.
I think some of that oil we actually can use just to reduce rates, you know, because like with Valero, we had a cut of Alaskan North Slope. We would run the Outer Continental Shelf, which is three platforms are restarted, and then we would run San Joaquin Valley crude. We would run a mixture of crude. So you probably run a decent amount of it. You just can't run up and match rates depending on the actual.
Well, isn't the Venezuela oil much thicker oil, and they have to make changes to all the refineries to use it?
It's heavier. Well, no, the heavier oil is actually what the heavier sour oil is most of the refiners were designed to run in the state. So that would go fine. The thing is, you're looking at the crude oil. That does not affect the products. That doesn't affect the refineries that are down. Will it help us? Of course. We should be producing our own. Will it help us? Yeah, it'll help stabilize our crude supply. But it actually help the state out in the grand scheme of things? No, not very much. We need to be producing our own. That would help us.
And have the ability to refine it.
Yes, that's the biggie.
That's the biggie.
So before we leave the idea of this, we talk about it a lot, the states, the program that is driving this, the catalyst for this whole nonsense of not utilizing our own resources, it has been cap and trade. So the idea that we would stop producing CO2, it's the whole global hysteria. So I just did a little search during the break, and just put in California cap and invest instead of cap and trade. They tried to doll it up by calling it cap and invest because, you know, it's
climate change, not global warming.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So here's the short description. California's cap and invest program, formerly cap and trade, is a key policy extended to 2045 via Assembly Bill 1207, designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 40% below 1990 levels. Not sure what was going on in 1990 that was so bad, but they're going to do that by 2030 and achieve net zero by 2045. So apparently all the plants will be dead because they use CO2, so we're going to have zero CO2 over the state of California, but the rest of the world is going to have it, just not here. We're not going to have it here. Right. So that makes no sense. It covers roughly 80% of the state's emissions by setting a declining limit on major polluters, provided that you think CO2 is pollution, using auction proceeds to fund climate projects. That sounds super legit. That actually sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit for, like, smart people.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, just legit projects like the high-speed rail. That's one of the big ones. Yeah.
Well, and so we learned a really long time ago from Leland Seward. Ha! That was in my Wayback Machine. Leland Seward, that was, like, I want to say 14 years ago. And he was a climate guy. And he said, so for all those people that tell you that CO2 is a pollutant, I want you to just, first of all, you confirm that with them. So you think CO2 is a pollutant? Yes.
Deadly,
yes, it is.
Deadly
pollutant, too, yes. You know, for that matter. He said, so did you know that CO2 is about 400 parts per million in the air that you currently breathe? But if you were to go down for some reason and you needed CPR and mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, that breathing into someone is 10,000 parts per million, or 40,000 parts per million. The math was easy, and I bungled it. So we go from 400 parts per million that we're breathing in real time to 40,000 parts per million breathed into you, which should make you...
dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except for it doesn't.
Yeah.
That's confusing.
How's that work? You're breathing poison into them.
And I just want you to know I have asked the climate alarmists this many, many times, too many to actually count. And every time I ask them why that is, why is that? That 10,000 parts per million breathed into another person doesn't make them die. And then they look at me I'm not sure if the math is confusing or I'm not sure what it is, but they always look at me like quizzically and hoping I'll get another idea and
because
not make them answer.
Because you're a troublemaker.
I am a troublemaker. And then they tell me
you're a contrary.
It's different.
Yeah.
That's the answer. It's different. That's why you don't die.
It's a different kind of CO2.
It's a different CO2.
Yeah. Different CO2, that's right.
Yeah.
Because that's the way elements work. You know, you have the periodic table, and then you have the other periodic table, and you have a different periodic table, because, you know, if you put it on the different periodic table, the C and the O and stuff,
yeah,
they're
yeah.
different.
Totally different.
Uh-oh. We just disconnected. Mike's head just exploded.
Yeah, he hung up, so hopefully I'll call him back.
Oh, he's probably driving. He is driving. There's Mike. He's like, whoops. He went through the cone
of
silence.
He's driving. He's breathing. Driving. He's breathing much more CO2.
He went through the cone of silence.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Anyway. Did you go through the cone of silence?
I went through somewhere. Well, the funny thing is that unit that they find Valero, the hydrogen generation unit, it makes hydrogen and CO2. That's what it makes.
Yeah.
One of the units they recover the CO2 and it goes over to liquid carbonics, which ends up in, you know, our drinks and different things. And the other unit, they just vent the CO2 to the atmosphere. So that's why, and every refinery has these and it has multiple of them most of the time. Because they have to have hydrogen for the process, you know, the ultra-low sulfur hydrodeurethanization units and all the other units that require hydrogen, hydrotreating units, well, they need hydrogen, so the refinery generates it. And in the process, you also make carbon dioxide. So that's, you know, one of them at Valero vented to the atmosphere. The other one, they recovered the carbon dioxide, sent it over liquid carbonics. So, you know, that was... Valero knew, the corporation knew, that was their bottom line, was it's CO2. It's that pollutes CO2, and that's why. You know, they said, there's carcinogens, there's reproductive harm agents, but let's look at the big picture. In 50-something years, Benicia's never had a cancer problem, never had a reproductive harm problem, nor has the industrial park, nor have the employees in the refinery, but they're emitting all this cancer, you know, and if you knew there were, and we both know, if there were cancer problems in Benicia, we would hear about it until the cows come home, you know, until we couldn't stand it anymore. So, well, they're doing this and that. No, it was all about the CO2, and that's why you can't run a hydrogen generation unit, you can't run a refinery.
It's inexplicable.
It's flawed science.
Considering CO2 makes plants grow, and if you have a greenhouse,
yeah.
they pump CO2 into greenhouses to make plants grow. So,
that's what we learned.
Yeah, yep. Right.
That's what we learned back in school.
Didn't we? Yeah.
Yeah, back in the prehistoric age when everything was green and we had huge plant life. CO2 was much, much higher than it is now.
Yeah.
I don't even think we can get it that high anymore.
So,
yeah.
At the end of the...
When we were growing...
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
I don't know.
You're in a bad spot.
You guys
Mike.
There?
Yeah, there we are.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get to work. Okay. Yeah, you look back at it, yeah, the air in the 70s sucked. I mean, it really did, you know, and even going to the 80s, but we made so many drastic improvements. By the time we hit the 90s, like they're talking about, unless we're having a big forest fire, the air is a heck of a lot better, much, much better than it was before. So a lot of things were accomplished. You know, we were on ultra-low sulfur diesel and ultra-low sulfur gasoline when I was running it. You know, so a lot of these things did take care of the air, but now it's like you said, you get that other 1% is going to collapse your entire economy, and they don't care, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a control mechanism. So let's take a really quick break. I've got some great medical. I have medical advice this break. I decided to go with some.
Oh, we all like that.
Yep, medical advice, sound medical advice.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.USMD.
brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the diamond. Sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called a doctor, woke him up and said, "Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take?" I said, "Doctor, to relieve this bellyache." I said, "Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take?" I said, "Doctor."
I like my steak well done, the taters fried, football games on Monday night. It's just who I am, a meat and potato man. I like my coffee black, old TV shows, my women hot and my beer ice cold. It's just who I am, a meat and potato man.
Sounds like he had a good mom. I'm going to this Mother's Day thing through the back door here. Play all the man songs.
Copy that.
Yeah, so, you know, we can go to the doctor and they can put the lime in the coconut, but I, you know, so I don't think that's good medical advice. It is fun, though, and it's a snappy song. But getting rid of all the CO2 so that we can, I don't know, say that we did it or something and make all our plants die. I don't think that's super smart. And kill our industry and make everyone poor.
Yeah. Well, and clearly starve everyone to death.
Oh, there's that.
Where that's heading if all the refineries shut down, yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that part. Sorry. No more meat and potatoes,
yeah,
man.
You got to remember that part. It's like some of these.
Uh-oh.
Oh, that was it.
Oh, mic's out.
Hold on.
So I'm looking at the two-pager, and I want to look at the solution. Mike's already read it, so when he gets back on, then he'll figure it out. But it says here, the only available near-term mitigation lever is to expand the pool of gasoline supply that can be accessed. That can be achieved by temporarily relaxing California's low-carbon fuel standard and allowing gasoline used in other parts of the country to be used in this state. Huh, what a great idea. However, since California has no inbound pipelines, the action will not result in additional gasoline at the pump until mid-May, unless more drastic measures such as rail or truck transportation is used. To replace a major pipeline such as the San Pablo Bay Crimson Line would require as many as, yep, you guessed it, 760 tanker trucks per day. Assuming equivalent volumes. Yeah, we thought, well, you were in the cone of silence. We thought we'd spoiler alert the solution. But see, this solution is from April 15th, nearly a month ago. So that whole idea that won't result in additional gasoline at the pump until mid-May, that was if they would have made a change back in the middle of April. But they didn't.
They did.
Yes.
The silence. But just pause a moment to just let that sink in, folks. So then accordingly, it says here, it is our opinion, so the two professors, and based on current public data, that California may experience gasoline shortages persisting well into June unless the low-carbon fuel standard is temporarily relaxed April 15th. In the time travel machine. Correspondingly, retail gasoline prices are expected to increase due to supply and sourcing issues, as well as regulatory costs, which routinely add to the price of gasoline on July 1st every single year. To address the imminency of the situation, the California legislature should consider, but didn't, suspension or revocation of the California special blend gasoline in favor of the national reformulated standard. I mean, honestly, switching to the same gas everyone uses all around the entire country.
Yeah, they're not complaining about
it. That's a no-brainer.
It is just a no-brainer, which is why our gas prices are always higher than anyone in the country.
Yes, that is correct. And the state of Washington's catching up with us.
In stupidity?
Washington to put in the same policies.
Right, right. Yeah,
like
so their, their stupidness is... Yeah, their stupidness
yes.
is catching up with our stupidness.
Now, is Washington going to go to a special blend?
They're on their way there. They're on their way there. They haven't quite hit it yet, but they got a lot of the same. They're employing a lot of the same regulations that we're using with cap and trade. I wouldn't be surprised if they try to go to a special blend. But yeah, you would think they would look at us and go, maybe
exactly.
that's not such a great idea.
This is a terrible plan. Wow. Isn't it amazing? We're not learners right now. We're in that phase of civilization where I guess we just don't learn.
Yeah, well, here in California we are. Like, wow.
So from a pollution standpoint, I know we've talked about this a little bit, but I seem to remember way back at the beginning of this discussion, like in December when we first started chatting with you guys, that all of this nonsense resulted in less than 1%, like cleaner air or something. What was the deal with that?
Reduction in pollutants, yes. Or what they consider to be pollutants, because like you were just making the big point about CO2. Mm-hmm. They consider CO2 to be a pollutant, and it's like, no, it's not.
Yeah, no, it makes plants grow. And so for that, that's why we're going through all this. A less than 1%.
Yes.
So, all right, you used to, run the refinery, not by yourself, but, used to run the refinery.
Uh-huh.
So... could you even tell? I mean, would anybody even be able to tell?
1%? I doubt it.
Yeah.
No,
you could, yeah.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. In the 70s, we could tell. I mean, the 70s, it was bad, and going in the 80s, it was still bad. But we've improved so much. Air quality has improved so much. Like I said, unless there's a fire, the overall air quality is phenomenally better than it used to be. So we have achieved a lot of, improvement. And when you think about it, Aaron, Bill, if we hadn't changed anything, the amount of cars we have on now, I mean, it would be terrible. So, our engine efficiencies have gone up, even the diesel trucks, the technology, changing diesel specs, diesel, like the hydro de-optimization of diesel, different things like that. It has improved. It's definitely improved. And we've done good to that accord, but now we've gone so far over the cliff, it's not even funny. With all the other things that we've already talked about, and to the point where you got three major corporations saying, "Hey, dude, you just sit down and talk to us, or we're probably going to shut down and leave." That says it all right there, as far as I'm concerned.
So to make the switch, okay, so you're running the refinery, and now they're going to allow you to have, the same kind of gas that everybody else has. How, what do you have to do? What happens?
With there's not a lot. You just don't blend as much alkylate, and you can use less of the alkylate, which is the higher octane. It's low olefin, real world sulfur, high octane blending component. Within our state, it's actually, since they're already doing it, you can drop the summer blend. That would be a big help. But we're already making our carb gas. There isn't a, to my understanding, is there's not really much they're going to do. They would do different. They can still make it. It's not going to increase any real significant volumes for us not to make it here. But it would allow other people that make it that's not carbob to bring their significant volumes to us. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at it, 100% gasoline production, the total volume, it might increase like by 3%, 2%, something like that. Maybe. It may not affect it at all, but it would allow us to start bringing fuel in here it's the regular federal blend.
Right. Now, where would that fuel come from?
Well, probably stuff like the Gulf Coast, that would be the biggest one. But you know, I don't know what all their numbers are as far as how I know that refineries are already maxed out. I know at Chalmette, New Orleans, they just had a fire. PBF had a fire on their reformer unit, so that one's partially down. You know, but to make up the volumes that we're talking about, I'm not sure.
The fuel they're manufacturing there now is all being used. It's all, I guess, spoken
for. That's the thing.
You know, so.
That's the thing, yes.
What, are we going to short everybody else so California can have more?
And no, they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that.
No.
And if they have extra fuel you got a European market or something like that, and they're going to pay you more, they're sending it there.
Right, right.
That's why California just really left itself flailing in the wind. From every aspect, from economics, the whole nine yards. We just really left ourselves so vulnerable and our military so exposed. And yeah, you're exactly right. If all their fuel is already spoken for.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, California.
Yeah, the obvious solution is, I think, the only solution. But they don't want to acknowledge it. I mean, they think, I guess this is all going to work itself out magically, and all we have to do is just stay the course. I don't see that happening.
Yeah, no. What are you hearing from? You've been talking to some of the other producers. Like, I know we were on a conference call with Ken the other day. So the guys that you're talking about that are moving oil and gas around, I mean, that's their job. We were hoping to have them on today, but yeah, it was Mother's Day.
Yeah.
What can you kind of summarize what they're telling you?
Shortages. They're starting to have problems. He told me specifically the same thing I've been telling some of the farmers that I deal with is, I know the price is expensive right now, but if you need some or you think you're going to need some, you should probably go ahead and stock up on it now, because he is also foreseeing problems with being able to get fuel, even diesel. He's foreseeing problems with being able to get diesel supply problems. So.
As a distributor, he's a fuel distributor.
As a distributor.
Yeah.
Yes. Hmm. Yeah. I'm just seeing it because I know what the rates are of those refineries. I know what got cut back. I know what's been lost. You know, I take Valero. I know the exact numbers of Valero and other refineries. I can, you know, if you're guessing jet fuel within a couple hundred barrels, like 500 barrels a day, I can pretty much guesstimate with an educated perspective on pretty much what every refinery is doing. It's like I know if we lose these other six refineries, it's 1.2 million barrels a day going offline of crude oil production, which is 42 times that. And if you multiply that by 0.5, it comes out to about 24 to 25 million gallons of gasoline a day production that's gone. Jet fuel, diesel, the numbers are tremendous. That's the thing. That's the part that literally scares me. We cannot make that up. There's no way we can't make that up.
No.
The situation our state's going to go into, the economical collapse we're going to see.
Yeah, and they know how much fuel is consumed daily in this state. You know, let's just say gasoline.
Yeah, last number I heard was 36 million. Last number I heard was about 36 million, Bill. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they have to be able to make that shortfall up. And if they don't, I mean, the outcome is pretty obvious, but they don't want to look at that. That's what just kind of blows my mind.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I know a lot of these numbers. I know what these refineries do, and yeah, that's the part. I totally agree with you. That's the part that blows my mind too. It's like, why are you guys not seeing this? And you know, I've gone on different, you know, like podcasts with like a retired Brigadier General Holt from the Air Force who flew the C-17 KC-135, and he was like a logistics guy at NATO. And it's like he was saying, you know, cities have 3 to 4 days of 5 days of food supply tops. And if you take away the diesel or severely cut the diesel fuel back, then you're not going to get transports. You're not going to have the Port of Los Angeles running. You're not going to be able to move food around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'll survive up where we're at for a while, but people that live in all the metropolitan areas, they're looking at real problems with food. It's like, you know, you can have all the money in the world. You want to stock a celery and you go to the store and it's not there, you're not going to get it. Or milk or anything else that's not there. And then some of these folks with the big houses, they're going to look like grocery stores to the mobs.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Yeah. And then we'll be sad that we converted our farmland to solar panels.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they're busy taking water away from our farmers. Now, you know, we're going to need those folks. We have concentrated them in some areas, and so much of our product is trucked. I mean, as a kid, we lived in the East Coast. We ate all of our vegetables really basically came out of a can. Everything came out of a can. You know, they don't grow vegetables there, and we didn't really have the transport situated to have big produce sections there. And then there's always the factor that it was probably quite expensive and we had 5 kids. So there was that. But hence the fact I never had a fresh mushroom till I moved to California and went to college. Where I had a roommate who told me upon entering my dorm that she didn't ever eat foods that squeaked. And I was like, I don't know of any foods that squeak. She said mushrooms, and I'm thinking about the mushrooms in a can. Well, hot tip, they don't squeak. I ate a real one, and by Jove, they squeaked. So on that happy note, let's take a really quick break because teed up the Farmer's Almanac. I thought it might be fun. Play something fun, right, with all our bad news bears. Something fun. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
A sweet old lady was 84 when her kin folks came for a month or more. Now from overwork, she's on the other shore. Much too late was y'all come back. And it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, visitors and fish smell after 3 days. Our leader was a silver-tongued man. He deceived the people of the land. And when he got caught, he couldn't stand. It's a little off beat and a little off track, but it says in the Farmer's Almanac, it says, in rivers and bad government, the lightest things float to the top.
Now don't talk to me about the polar bear. Don't talk to me about the ozone layer. Ain't so much of anything these days, even the air. They're running out of rhinos, what do I care? Let's hear it for the dolphin, let's hear it for the trees. Ain't running out of nothing in my deep freeze. It's casual entertainment.
Environmental song. Never gets old. It running out of nothing in my deep freeze. So Mike, you know, when you talk to somebody, you know, you're doing the same thing I'm doing. This is like, here, you know, you should look all this stuff up. Do you know what's going on? What do people typically, what's their initial response? Do they believe you?
No, not all of them. I'd say a lot of them don't. They just, despite the fact of what's going on around them in front of their very eyes, no, they don't. Some do. Some will listen. You know, I'll give out one of the cards, talk to them. Some of them I'll even show them, here, just look that up. You know, you want to find out what's really going on. You know, this is the domain here, you know, and I'll tell them it's me and Professor and, and Sandy and Stan Ellis, you know, all combined working on this. And yeah, sometimes it's very frustrating. I got I was pulling up. You were asking about Valero.
Yeah.
You know, this is also why it's frustrating. Is a guy named Rob I used to work with. He just messaged me, not right now, but a little while before. But, you know, he says, my true feelings for Benicia were that we all, whether we were Exxon or Valero, because me and Rob hired on in 90 together when it was Exxon. But he said, whether Exxon or Valero, we all had strong ethical strengths and absolutely the best training for everyone was given. Anyone who left our site, they were superstars at any other facility that they went to. We valued our training department and ensured that our folks checked every single box and became highly qualified operators.
Well, they're
so that slowly, is a lot of frustration.
Yeah, they're going away to other plants, and chances are,
well, they're gone. They're gone. A lot of them left like 3 months ago. Yeah, I got a couple of my buddies I talked to said, yeah, well, if we could really. You know, the professor's executive orders number 6 was to reanimate Benicia. You know, and they told me if that really happened, there's a couple of the guys says I'll come. One's in retirement, about my actually a couple years younger than me. And you know, he said I'll come back. He says Mike, that happens. If you get involved, we'll come back. So you know, but still going to be way short of the people you need, man, especially in the control room. Hmm. That's where you run into trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't have unqualified people or undertrained people in an operation like that and not have a catastrophe. I mean, that's the thing
that people don't understand. I know you got it and Aaron's got it. You got to have experience. You got to be trained, but you got to have time behind, you know, especially that control room. It was like almost three years before you were fully considered qualified. And that was, you already had 3 units outside. You were qualified on at least a minimum of 3 units out the field. And then you came in the control room and you trained. And if your boss was good, he sent you to other field classes. Mine was. He sent me to all 8 of the ones that we control. But this is years of experience and seeing things. You know, there's so many things I dealt with and fixed. And sometimes you had 10 or 15 seconds to make million-dollar decisions. One time I shut down a piece of equipment. The seal was bad. It was leaking hydrogen sulfide out of these seals. And the rotating equipment folks had looked at it a couple times, and the operator, Daryl, he calls me out there, calls me at the control room, and says, Mike, these seals are getting pretty bad here. You know, so and it's kind of funny. The rotating equipment supervisor was in there at the same time in the control room, and I go, is that you, Daryl? Well, Dale Cross, the guy, the supervisor, he said, well, they're going to send a couple guys to look at it. What do you think, Daryl? And he says, well, I don't know, Mike. It's getting pretty bad. I go, okay, are you upwind of it? Okay. Then I call up the crude unit guy to go over to a couple chain valves he was going to need to go to. And I got up. I walked right around. I said, excuse me. I went to the back panel. Okay, I go, C601 coming down. I tripped the compressor offline. I shut the isolation valves. I depressured that part of the unit to the flare. And I walked back to the supervisor and said, he'll have your permit ready to work on it in about 30 minutes. And the guy's face was just, he was just like stunned. It's like, no, you're not, you know, that was part of my job, was to make sure that no harm came to the citizens of Benicia or anybody in the plant. And that one decision cost the refinery about $300,000 a day. And, you know, the next day the refinery manager came in there and said, hey, Mike, thanks for shutting that down. Those seals were worse than what the rotating equipment people thought they were. So he's like, you know, he doesn't want to see something like that either. But that was very rare. But, you know, that was your job in there, the safety of everybody in the plant, the whole city of Benicia. I was responsible for that. And I took that responsibility seriously. And the people were trained, the operators were trained to look at these things, evaluate them, and make the decisions. You know, because at nighttime, there's nobody there. The managers aren't there. It's your team. It's your team of operators and shift superintendent running the place. And you all relied on each other. So, and that type of camaraderie, there was a lot of that there. It's all gone. Plant that was the shining star of the state that should be taking care of us right now is offline. And it's offline for no reason other than this governor and his air board.
Well, just out of curiosity, we never really, I think I spoke with you about it on the phone, but we never really discussed the whole deal with what this did to the communities surrounding these plants. So not only are we starving the state for fuel and the military and our airports and all this stuff, but what did that do for their local community?
Well, Benicia lost 15% to 20% of its budget. There's rotating equipment companies that fix the pumps and compressors. They lost all their business. They had to shut down different fitters, manufacturers, welders, a bunch of these different companies that worked. You know, there was a mechanical crew that was contractor mechanical crew that worked in the refinery every day. They're gone. All the collateral damage, you know, businesses, shops, restaurants. Benicia lost at least 15% of its entire budget, maybe 20% of its budget. And then Valero, Exxon, then Valero, you know, they used to take, my dad was the assistant fire chief and an operator technician, but he was assistant fire chief for a while. You know, and dad told me, though, they would take, Benicia firefighters to San Antonio to Texas A&M, take them to school, take them to training, back to Reno when, you know, we used to all go to Reno fire training when Reno had a training ground. But Exxon and Valero would pay to take their firefighters. They helped them buy good equipment. They would buy Benicia. The city of Benicia itself didn't need, you know, anything more than ambulance and its you know, basic fire engine. Well, Valero, Exxon bought them better, more state-of-the-art equipment and kept them up to date and kept them trained on it. And they would train together. They would work together. They contributed a lot to the schools. There's a lot of collateral things that the refinery did as a partner with the city. It's gone now. And I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor, who was on the air board that got Valero fined. I mean, such a big conflict of interest there. You know, you're on the air board and you're getting the company fined. You really, I hope, you know, they enjoy that little bonus they're getting, because after that, it's gone. And right now, unless the president intervenes and someone, you know, and he give Valero somebody to come back, Benicia, it's gone. They've lost it. It's gone.
Yeah, because they're how much of their budget was going away because of Benicia closing? Wasn't it
something like 20%?
Yeah, and 20%. I don't know how you make that up. You don't make it up right away. That's a lot.
Well, you look at the Bill. I mean, you look at the refinery. I mean, just take a look at it. There's nothing like that in Benicia. Not even close. Nothing even 1,000th of that.
Right.
So it's like, you don't have to be an economics major to understand these things. That damn thing shut down. Benicia's hurting now, and it's going to hurt.
Well, meanwhile, what do you do with that whole big facility? I mean,
well, they're turning it into a terminal. They're trying to. They're thinking they're going to get, you know, make it into a terminal. I think they're actually partially using it for a terminal now. But now there's no ships coming, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
Wait, they're turning.
The rest of
wait,
the facility, honestly,
into,
I don't know.
They're turning it into what?
A terminal. They're basically using the dock to offload products, jet, diesel, gasoline, basically pump from the dock into the product tanks that the refinery has, and then from the refinery product tanks, they pump it out to Kinder Morgan or Brisbane. They pump it out to the distribution pipelines. So they basically offload the tanker through the dock to a product tank, and then once that's offloaded and the product tank's full, then they pump that product tank out to the system into the state.
But the actual refinery is just sitting there?
Yes.
Okay.
So what is that, like 5% of the operation they're going to keep functioning in another format? The rest?
Yeah, they're keeping wastewater online, the dock, and two of what they call the oil movements posts, which are the tank movements, the tank farms. So a total of something like 5 operators, maybe 6, 7, say 10 operators, and then 3 shifts.
Right.
So,
which is a small fraction of what was there. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It'll have a huge impact.
Wow. That's totally stupid. Huh.
Well, it is. I get a little depressed when I think about it. And that was the shining jewel of the state. That refinery was the shining jewel of the state. And I'm not knocking the other ones, because all those ladies and gentlemen, they work their tails off and they keep their units running and keep things up online. But Valero was designed differently. The training was different. From the get-go, when you stepped in the gate, it was different. I've been into the other refineries. It was definitely different.
And different in, like, a high-quality sort of way.
Yes, exactly. A higher quality of training. Well, because you cross-trained on different units that you don't cross-train on in other refineries. That's why, like me, I have an understanding of almost how an entire refinery runs. Pressures, temperatures, levels, flows, the problems, you know, what you can do, what it can't do. You don't get that in another refinery. You got a CAT unit with its own control room, with its own operators. You got a crude unit with its own control room, with its own operators. In Benicia, the CAT unit, coker, sulfur, fuel gas, MEA, tail gas, a bunch of other subsidiary units were all controlled from one control room. And I was cross-trained, you know, and all the guys, like my father was cross-trained. Rob, the guy that wrote that, was cross-trained on six of the units on the other complex. So that's where the training was really, it was really phenomenal there. And this was a concept from Exxon all the way back to 1969 when they built the place.
And how different is that? You know, I know you said it's far superior, but what did the... What happens in the other ones? You said that the jobs were more siloed.
They bring you in for more time. They bring you in. Well, it's just isolated. You got the CAT cracker. It's got its own control room. It's got its own operators. And then these operators have been there 20, 30 years, you know, 30 years. So you come in, they'll start training you in different sections of that one unit, and you'll qualify, and then eventually you'll I can't speak for all of them, but just roughly, you know, maybe after 2 or 3 years, you'll start working in the control room on that CAT cracker.
What does that even mean?
Valero,
you say that all the time, and I just want you to know, since, you know, it's radio and you can't see us, every time you say that, we laugh, but because it's just a funny name, but we have no idea really what you're talking about.
It's your biggest gasoline-making unit in the refinery. It actually circulates a fluid solid. It's like those... suspended solid units, the cogens that we were talking about. Yeah. This one actually circulates the fluid solid between two vessels, and they bring in the motor oil to stuff that's almost as heavy as like gear oil, and they actually break it on a molecular level and convert it into gasoline, as much gasoline as they can get. It's a whole different school on it, but it's your big gasoline maker. And the refinery taking the heavier oils and converting them into gasoline components, or converting them into like gas oils that can go on to another unit and be converted into gasoline. So it's your biggest money maker in the whole plant.
It's its own world, and it's funny because when you drive down there, you drive down there and you go past all that. It's like, I don't know. So, like, it looks like its own giant town.
Yes, it literally is.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you, would it make any sense for them to come back? Obviously, you don't work for Valero. I mean, you don't get to speak for them, but just with what you know about what it would take to spool it up again, what do you think? You think they would even do that?
If they follow a template of the professor's template on that executive order 6 that he drew up, they might very well do it. But you got to, again, what's happening 2 or 3 years down the road, stuff like that, those concerns that you brought up in previous shows. So they have to have reassurance. They got to know they're going to come back and make some money and not be dealing with the same thing 2 or 3 years down the road. The professor's template was for a seven-year contract with Valero, and then all of Valero's production would go to military or go to working with the governor of Nevada, go to Nevada. So Valero would provide for the military and the governor of Nevada, and that basically their product would already be guaranteed to be purchased. So those are incentives. You know, the professor knows the economics and far more than most people in the world. You know, so those are incentives that can bring them back. But they got to do it. They got to get it done. The longer it sits, it's not good.
No, any machinery, if it sits unused for any length of time, you've got to replace it. Replace it or repair it, because it degrades.
Exactly.
Yeah, we've seen that in the mill industry. They shut these mills down, and there's no way to restart them. They just sell it off, and it's gone. So...
Yeah, once they start selling stuff off on a refinery, like I think they may be doing that down in Wilmington, bringing it back is going to be a bear.
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Extremely expensive.
Wow. Yep. So we're kind of on the bubble at this point. This will be the happiest show we do on this topic right now, because we're headed into the darkness on this. So for people who think that the prices are high now and that we've got issues, good luck with that. We do hope that you will go and share this with other people. You can get directly to this information at gascrisis.org. We're looking to do some town halls throughout the state of California to bring this information to people from the experts, Mike and all the other fellers. And we want to thank you. Got to run away. Happy Mother's Day, Mike.
Right, thanks again. Happy Mother's Day, Aaron. Thank you, Bill. Thank you both.
Yep, you bet.
All right. Again, you can go straight to that page at gascrisis.org, and that takes you to the radio page, too. Welcome to the Twilight Zone. Yep. Hit it, Alex.
Oh,